Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's show, we continue our week-long series on the $80 billion yearly U.S. prison system by talking about reform and rehabilitation. For decades, California had one of the worst recidivism rates in the country, contributing to its overcrowding issues. California Governor Jerry Brown issued a series of proposals that would become the basis for realignment. On October 1, 2011, realignment kicked in, moving nonviolent, non-serious, non-sexual offenders from state authority to counties. The state gave counties $400 million to offset the cost as individuals moved from state supervision to the local level, and each county was required to submit their realignment implementation plans. Now, prior to realignment, 60% of parolees were rearrested within the first year and 80% within 3 years. We'll talk about what that looks like today. And then we had the statewide initiative Prop 47, which passed in November. It reduced nonviolent crimes like property and drug crimes from felonies to misdemeanors. After its passage, 2,700 inmates were released from California's prisons. And now there's a debate about whether realignment and Prop 47 have led to an increase of low-level crime on city streets. According to the California Corrections Department, since 2011, because of realignment and Prop 47, the state prison population has decreased by 27,000. So what does that mean exactly? What does effective prison reform and rehabilitation look like? What resources are available inside and outside of prison to help people with the transition process? And also, what prevents released inmates from going back to prison? Joining us today to talk about these issues is Darris Young, a community organizer with the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights. He's a certified substance abuse, domestic violence, and youth violence prevention counselor. And Darris spent 17 years in prison, and he joins me in studio. Hi, Darris. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. Thank you for coming in. We're also joined by Elizabeth Siggins. She directs Californians for Safety and Justice's Local Safety Solutions Project, which provides city and county officials with training and tools to implement policies that improve safety and reduce costs. Elizabeth spent almost 10 years with the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, where she drafted many of the major reforms for California's Division of Juvenile Justice, formerly the California Youth Authority, which we talked about on yesterday's show. And Elizabeth Siggins joins us on the phone from Sacramento. Hi, Elizabeth. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. So we've been talking about so many issues all week, and prison reform is getting so much attention in the national media. And I wonder, I want to start off with you, Darris. What do we mean when we say reform? Because that word's just been thrown around so much. What is the word reform? When we talk about prison reform, what does that mean to you?
Well, first of all, I think that I need to tell you what I believe it means to people who are talking about prison reform, because it's quite different than what it means to me. I think from the official's point of view, prison reform just means finding a way to let people out of prison and pretty much go on his or her own without any type of direction or plan or even resources to help to get a person reintegrated back into society in a meaningful way. And so for me, prison reform is just not letting individuals go from prison, although that's a big part. But I believe that it first should start with preparation. And quite frankly, since maybe the mid-1970s, early 80s, when we started to see a rise in the recidivism rate, California hasn't done anything nearly enough to actually prepare men and women for a life outside of prison. Many of the programs that were once innovative in California, they left in the mid-70s once we went into this mass incarceration mode without any type of rehabilitation. Hmm. And as you might be aware, California at one time actually was a leader during the 70s and, you know, the early 70s and late 60s in the types of like programs and services that were available to men and women while they were in prison. But I think that with the expansion of prison We started building more and more of our institutions in rural counties, rural areas. And what this actually did, it brought like income into those areas. But what it also did was it brought prisons in areas where people were not concerned about individuals, especially individuals from the inner cities. So what you had was a lack of viable programs available to men and women in that were incarcerated coming from communities outside. And I think that if one were to do a study, and I've talked with individuals about this all the time, if we want to measure the effectiveness of prisons, I'm not lifting up one prison system over the other, but I think that we have to look at how San Quentin has operated in the last 20 or so years. They're situated in an area where they have hundreds of volunteers come in, and they run effective programs like the No More Tears program, the restorative justice programs, the substance abuse counselor certification programs. They have many programs that come in, and I think that if you measure the individuals that are actually paroling from San Quentin and that have taken part in these programs prior to getting out of prison, I would guarantee you that you would see, hey, you know what? These individuals, they have fared much better than other individuals who have paroled from prisons that are in these rural areas that basically offered little to nothing.
That is so interesting. So San Quentin in Marin County, because of its location, you're saying that people from the surrounding areas are able to actually get involved in the prison and volunteer. Whereas I've been to Chowchilla, which is sort of right between San Francisco and LA. It takes about 5 hours to get there. It's really hard for even family members to go visit their loved ones in prison, let alone people volunteering their time. I've never really heard anyone talk about it like that.
Yes, and I think it came to light with me when I was incarcerated for 17 years. You know, there were, it was at a time, my incarceration actually came as a result of the three strikes law. So you're talking about like 95, 96, 97 and on when this really tough on crime policies were actually started. So, you know, my first few years of prison, I was situated in High Desert State Prison, which is in Susanville, California. And at that time, you know, I knew I had a long time to do. So I began to think about my future and what would it mean for me when I got out of prison. And so I said, you know, this is a time where I really did a lot of reflection. So I wanted to get involved in things that would help me examine myself, to help me improve myself. So when I got out of prison, I would at least have a footing to be able to get some type of stronghold with back and within my community, and to have some sort of training and viable skill that would allow me to be marketable when I got out. But however, there wasn't anything up there. And so that was at the time when the federal government said, we're not going to allow incarcerated individuals to profit while they're in prison. That was their language, profit while in prison, by allowing them to go to school anymore on Pell Grants and stuff. So because I didn't have, you know, a family member with this tons of money to be able to pay for like college courses and things of that nature, right, then I couldn't even do that. And I was in a place where they didn't have the volunteer college prep program like they have at San Quentin that was run through Patton University. They were able to come in. Those type of things, they weren't available. And so without those type of resources available, you might have a man or a woman who has begun to think about their future and actually have made amends with themselves, and they want to make amends to the community around them. But at the same time, there's really a lack of resources that are there inside so that a person can benefit while they're paying back what they call, what society calls our debt to society.
That is Darris Young. He's a community organizer with the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights, talking about the 17 years he spent behind bars. He's now a certified substance abuse, domestic violence, and youth violence prevention counselor. We're also joined by Elizabeth Siggins. She directs Californians for Safety and Justice's Local Safety Solutions Project. Elizabeth, there's so much talk now about reform, and now Prop 47 is getting a lot of attention. A lot of people are talking about the effects of realignment and Prop 47. But what about this very important piece of this conversation about the programs that are available inside and outside of prison? We've been talking about this all week, and it just seems like you know, Darris was saying, no two prisons are the same. You might have really good programs at San Quentin, but not really good programs at the prisons in the rural areas.
That's absolutely right. You know, I spent many years working with the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation and trying to find ways to bring in more effective programming and to improve access to programming. The reality is a very small percentage of people who are in prison or in jails have access to those programs. And Darris is 100% right that San Quentin has thousands of volunteers, actually, and every other prison in the state scales in comparison, pales in comparison to the kinds of access to programming that they have there because of the incredible community around San Quentin that is interested in committed into coming in and providing programs. But you know, I think that the other point that Darris brought up that's really important is, I mean, while absolutely yes, we need to be improving and increasing access to programs that are in prison, and we need to have access to college programs and substance abuse programs and all of that. If we're waiting to talk about programming until someone is in the prison or the jail system, we've missed the game, and we're never going to be as effective as we want to be. And I think what you see with reforms like public safety realignment in 2011 was you saw even the legislature and the governor's office beginning to understand that, wait, the old system was not working. It was not effective, as the recidivism rates that you identified at the beginning of the show pointed out, and it was also incredibly expensive. And so we're going to start moving, you know, lower-level offenders out into the local communities where hopefully they can get access to a different range of services and not just, fall back on our traditional reliance on incarceration. And then just last year, we saw the voters say again, no, we do not want to see, you know, these really low-level offenders in prison. It's not the right use of our resources. And not only do we not want to see them incarcerated, we actually want to see that money invested instead into substance abuse treatment and mental health treatment in the communities. We want to see actual services for victims in the communities. We don't want to wait until someone is in prison or jail to spend that money on trying to provide those services at that point. And so I think it's incredibly, incredibly important that we've got people, and as you pointed out at the beginning, all over the country, and really, you know, potentially from all political spectrums at this point, starting to talk about we need to look at diverting people away from prisons and jails and not relying on that as our primary solution to public safety. But we're talking about diverting. We have to ask the question, divert to what?
Right.
And until we're investing in the necessary programs that we need in the community, we're setting ourselves up for, you know, continuing to rely on what we've traditionally funded, which is incarceration.
So I'll ask you what I've asked all guests this week. Are you hopeful about this conversation? Because as Darris just said, it can't stop at the point where you just let the person out of prison. And guests on a show we did on Tuesday about where the money goes, these guests said these politicians that are calling for reform are the same politicians that want to cut the very services that these people need both inside and outside of prison.
Yeah, those are fantastic points. So, yes, I am incredibly hopeful. And as someone who's been working on criminal justice reforms for several decades, I've never seen the kind of attention to this. I've never seen presidential. They're talking about this in presidential debates right now, right? I mean, so there's definitely a broad and wide-scale interest in this. But it has got to go very much beyond the surface of that. And so while I'm very hopeful, I'm also very nervous because, you know, there are also opponents at work looking to immediately point to, you know, anything that goes wrong with a reform and say, see, this doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And if we don't invest into these alternatives, you know, the real programs that are effective in dealing with substance use disorder and mental health problems and adverse childhood experiences in the community, you know, then we're going to be at risk for people saying, oh, we tried it and it didn't work.
What would you add to that?
Well, first of all, I would say this, and in going back to the beginnings of realignment, and while you said some things that are really, that I'm really in agreement with, I think the one thing that we're misled in, and that's the fact that California Governor Brown actually came up with this great, great idea for prison realignment. And if you recall, it was forced because the United States Supreme Court felt that they sided with the people when they said that the system was so overcrowded that it was denying the constitutional rights to effective medical care and mental health care. So what happened was they just hastily came up with this realignment system. Okay, let's send men and women, you know, to the custody of the county jails, non-serious and non-violent felons. And so virtually they created a funding stream. But the problem with that is that they did not tell the counties how to spend this money. They left it for them to decide on their own where the money should go. And so what that did, it always goes into the hands of, like, law enforcement. Like, take, for instance, in Alameda County, the county where we do our most of our work at, and we had our 50% Jobs Not Jails campaign. The reason we called it 50% Jobs Not Jails is because realignment, before realignment had come into play, the Alameda County jail numbers were steadily dropping. And so, but yet, for the first 3 years, 4 years of realignment, the Alameda County Sheriff was commanding 50% or more of the funding. So when you have nothing mandated to say this is how you should spend your money, this is what you should do inside of the jail with the money, it becomes very problematic because now you're leaving the very people that have invested in incarceration, locking people up, and then holding them. What we're doing is virtually replicating what the state system has done. So I say, while the numbers have dropped in the state prison system, you know, I'm often saying that we should not be, like, too giddy about that, because are we actually decreasing the numbers, or are we just redistributing the numbers of people that are actually incarcerated so that they can't be counted as state prisoners? But what about the men and women that are still going in and out of the county jail system now? And even though we know that has dropped significantly in some counties with the passage of Proposition 47, there it hasn't been seen. The effects have not been seen, I don't think, for realignment until the men and women that have been sentenced to county jail time that has been serving upwards to 3, 4, 5 years start to come out of the system and see how they start to fare. So I don't think the effects of AB 109 can be measured accurately right away. I think it begs to be seen what's being done, like maybe 7 to 8 years, maybe 10, after realignment has been in effect.
Darris Young is a community organizer with the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights and a certified substance abuse, domestic violence, and youth violence prevention counselor. He spent 17 years in prison. Elizabeth Siggins directs Californians for Safety and Justice's Local Safety Solutions Project. She spent almost 10 years with the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, where she drafted many of the major reforms for California's Division of Juvenile Justice, formerly the California Youth Authority. And today on on Your Call, we are continuing our week-long series on the U.S. prison system. We're talking today about reform and rehabilitation. This is getting a lot of attention because of realignment and Prop 47. According to the California Corrections Department, since 2011, 20,000 people, the state prison population, has decreased by 27,000. So today we're talking about the services that are available both inside and outside of prison. Our guests note that at a place like San Quentin, because of its location, you've got amazing programs and so many volunteers. But at prisons that are in rural areas, you just don't have that many services. They're out of the way. A lot of people don't even know they're there. And so we want to talk about that, and also what prevents released inmates from going back to prison. Daris just mentioned that if someone spends 5-10 years in prison, they go back to a community that looks completely different from when they left. So what questions do you have about reform and rehabilitation, about realignment, about Prop 47? If you work on these issues, we'd love to hear from you. If you or someone you know spent time behind bars, talk about the process of rehabilitation, the transition process. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So to stick with the issue of realignment, you were pointing out the example of Alameda County. And Alameda County received more than $30 million from the state every year since 2011, and the Ella Baker Center put on a successful program to get the Board of Supervisors to set aside half of the county's realignment budget for reentry programs and services that help people coming out of jail to rebuild their lives. So talk about how that was done and what changes you expect to see as a result.
Well, first of all, we began to examine what was going on in Alameda County versus what went on in our neighboring county, San Francisco and Contra Costa County. And what the Ella Baker Center seen, as also some of our partners within a coalition that we were part of, which is called the AC3JR Coalition, which stands for the Alameda County Criminal Justice Coalition for Change, we saw that right away there was a great disparity in the amount of money that was going to the sheriff and probation and the district attorney versus to the community-based organizations that would actually be depended upon and charged with delivering the services needed for reentry, for men and women to have a chance to successfully reintegrate back into society. So we began to look at these numbers of the large amounts of numbers that our sheriff was getting, and we thought that the minuscule amount of dollars going to the service providers for education, employment services, mental health counseling, substance abuse counseling, housing, all these things that were being relied upon for the public sector or the private sector to do, they were off base. Whereas in Contra Costa County, we saw that right away they actually gave 60% of, I believe it was their year 3 AB 109 funding to programs and services to run both inside and outside of the jail. And they were already beginning to show an effectiveness in the recidivism rate. It was really down. And then some of the things that San Francisco were doing. So we began to look at all of these things and ask ourselves the question, why is it still this way in Alameda County, which builds itself on being a more progressive county than Contra Costa? So with that said, we went to the Board of Supervisors and we pointed out a lot of the disparities in what was going on. And
hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break. Today, we're continuing our series on the U.S. prison system by talking about what effective reform and rehabilitation look like. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW. To join in today's conversation, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. 866-798-TALK. If you'd prefer to write rather than call, the email address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock from the BBC, World Have Your Say. And then at noon today, Bina from our friends at the San Francisco Jewish Community Center. Then this afternoon at 1, David LaTulipe and Open Air.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will end our week-long series on the U.S. prison system by talking about media coverage of the issues we focused on this week. How did we get here? Solitary confinement, youth, reform. We will talk about how these issues compare to what happens in other countries. So what does it look like, for example, in Germany when it comes to sentencing and prison practices? We will also talk about the arrests of hundreds of human rights lawyers and activists in China. That is tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we're talking about what effective prison reform and rehabilitation look like. There's such a heated conversation in the national media about prison reform, but what does that actually look like on the ground? What does it look like for someone who's behind bars or someone who gets out after serving 10 or 20 years? We're talking about this with Darris Young. He spent 17 years in prison. He's a community organizer with the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights and a certified substance abuse, domestic violence, and youth violence prevention counselor. Elizabeth Siggins directs Californians for Safety and Justice's Local Safety Solutions Project. She spent almost 10 years with the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. And if you'd like to join us, if you have questions about reform, rehabilitation, realignment, Prop 47, and all of these issues, because they're all connected, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. If you work on any of these issues, or if you have personal experiences with the prison system, we'd also love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can email us, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Before we get to calls, just one more question on Alameda County. Because of this change now, again, they're getting $30 million from the state each year because of realignment. What tangible changes do you expect to see, Darris?
Well, first of all, I expect to see the money that we just advocated for, the 50% of the realignment funding that is going to go to community-based organizations. I expect that the county should make sure that this is not a one-time thing. Because in retrospect, I think it was last October, the Public Policy Institute, they issued a report on realignment. And one of the things that they actually pointed out was that counties that spend more money on reentry services, they are going to fare better in realignment than those that spend more money on with their local sheriff's department. And that's just a fact. So we need to have an expectation that each year the funding would be available to community-based organizations. And then I do expect, and I would expect, and we're getting some pushback in here, that the community would actually have a voice in shaping what these services look like. Because once again, you know, our people who are responsible for writing the contracts to the various organizations for employment, education, and a host of other things that men and women need to actually become successful in society, they do it from the experts' point of view that tend to side with law enforcement. And so when law enforcement and corrections, they look at the incarceration problem, they only look at it from the bottom end, rather than from the top. So if you look at it from the top, from where we're sitting from, then you have to start with poverty. And so when you're writing these contracts, if you don't address the issue of poverty, like take, for instance, employment, service providers who actually are charged with getting individuals ready or providing them with employment, right? there's little subsidized employment, and counties have money to subsidize employment. So if you subsidize the employment longer, right, then what happens is that men and women who actually do not have what we call the soft life skills, right, they can be getting those too while the employer is actually, you know, not incurring all of the costs, but the employer is actually getting subsidized while men and women actually learn these skills that are needed to actually become productive in society. Now, at the same time, I do expect that men and women that are actually incarcerated, they get the chance while they're incarcerated at the county level to be able to take advantage of some of the things that should be going on inside. But what we are finding in our county and in other counties that I've talked to, from Los Angeles to San Diego County, is that, you know, the people who want to come in and volunteer their times and services, they're not being given access. So what I think about that is the culture of law enforcement agencies, it has to change, because the culture says that, you know, we're here to enforce the law. We're not here to invest in you. And basically, we want to create this condition to where when I let you out of the door, I can say bye-bye, I see you again.
And Elizabeth, since you spent 10 years, almost 10 years, at the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, what are your thoughts about what Darris just said about the culture of law enforcement and how that affects this process?
You know, I think that one of the things that we have recognized as part of the Local Safety Solutions Project with Californians for Safety and Justice is that cultural shift is fundamental. And so part of what we've been doing is working to identify forward-thinking law enforcement leaders who are willing to step up and take a stand for these kinds of shifts. And, you know, District Attorney George Gascon from San Francisco is a great example of that, you know, as is District Attorney Jeff Rosen from Santa Clara. I mean, these are people who realize and they're willing to say that our over-reliance on incarceration has not been effective for public safety, and that true public safety needs to look different than how we've traditionally run. We need to try the programs. We need to be investing up front, et cetera. So absolutely, it's a key component to a real cultural shift, which is what we need to make these reforms successful.
Well, you can join us if you'd like to weigh in on these issues. We're talking today on Your Call about what real reform and rehabilitation look like, and we're talking with Darris Young. He spent 17 years in prison. He's a community organizer with the Ella Baker Center. Elizabeth Siggins spent 10 years, almost 10 years, at the California Department of Corrections, and she now directs Californians for Safety and Justice's Local Safety Solutions Project. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Robert in Richmond. Hi, Robert. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you very much, and I wanted to thank your guests, Darris and Elizabeth, I think it is. I am a lawyer who actually works with people who run providers for group homes for adolescents and adults, and I take care of their regulatory compliance issues, and I can tell you that in the last 7 years at least, the rates that they get reimbursed with, particularly in adolescent group homes, were frozen for, I think, easily 4 years. Meaning that they wouldn't re-rate a new home. They wouldn't grant a certification to get paid to a new home for about 4 years in Alameda County, at least, and down in Santa Clara County as well. And they wouldn't raise the rate for providers. And as Darris said, you know, there's a diversion of money to these counties, and somewhere the irrigation system is being cut off. It's not getting into the ground of the people who actually are in the houses providing these services. And the services are critical. The other thing I wanted to say is that I also do what you call exemptions for people who have a prior conviction. If you want to get a job in a public agency, you generally can't get it if you still have a felony on your record, sometimes even a misdemeanor. And so there are processes available for people to appeal those kinds of exclusions. But nobody tells you about them. Nobody, you know, they're very hard to understand and how to do. There are people who do them. I'm not certainly the only one. So I just wanted to say I agree with everything that I'm hearing, but most particularly about this cutoff of the money. It just doesn't hit the service providers. It's locked in somewhere in the middle management or upper management range, and it's a waste.
Well, thank you for calling in. We actually talked about the process of expunging your record. I think that was on yesterday's show or maybe Wednesday's show. You can find it at yourcallradio.org. And then when it comes to the money that is wasted, Elizabeth, what is the transparency process like?
You know, it's really hard to figure that out. And actually, that's one of the other things that we're working on is how do you help local citizens sort of understand how their money, the local money is being spent. You know, it's tough. I mean, these budgets are big. You know, one of the problems that happens when you start talking about public safety is it gets very easy for people to quickly be reactionary and, you know, where this is, you know, sort of present the doomsday scenario if we change things around, and so it can be very tough. I mean, I think more and more we are seeing, and in part because of this increased interest in these reforms, I think we're seeing much more advanced dialogue around this, and people looking for much more accountability. But it is tough. Particularly, you know, we talk about money going to local departments. Well, then the question is, you know, how much of that is then going out to contract directly to the community-based organizations? You know, like was just discussed. And I think we need to be asking those questions more and more. We need to be looking at, you know, how do we identify what the savings is and how is it being spent and is it in fact being reinvested into the kinds of things that the voters, you know, and the public have clearly articulated that they want to see their public dollars spent on.
Right. We did a show about how the money is spent, who actually profits off the $80 billion yearly prison industry. And we talked about the fact that the state of California spends about $90,000 per prisoner per year. It's a lot more for youth. It's about $220,000. And so we talked about how that money is allocated. Do you want to add anything to that, Darris?
Well, I would just say that, you know, some of the things that we're talking about now, they could actually be fixed as we speak. All it takes is the legislatures to say, you know, in examining realignment and the effectiveness of it over these last few years, let's say to counties, this is how you should be spending the money that we are investing in to realignment. We would like to see you spend it like this. Give a mandate instead of allowing them to decide how they want to spend it, because when this happens, it's going to always be one-sided because we use these scare tactics. Like for instance, you know, one of the tactics that our sheriff made used to say that they needed more of the money was that, well, you know, we're keeping state prisoners now. They're more sophisticated, more dangerous. And so what this was, it was actually a smokescreen because county jails have always kept state prisoners. They've kept people who are headed to state prison, going through the justice process. They have kept people who may not have been sent to state prison on that occasion, but has spent time a year or less in the county jail on a short sentence. So to say that they were keeping more sophisticated, more dangerous criminals, these are things that they use to get the public on their side so that they can actually command more of the dollars and cents. And to do what? You know, where's the accountability? And so when you can use these type of tactics over and over again, the unsuspecting public, they hear, oh, state prisoner, dangerous, more money to the sheriff.
And so what was the reasoning behind that, Elizabeth? What was the reasoning behind the state to give the control to the counties when it comes to how they spend the money?
You know, I think that it was really clear that there is not a one-size-fits-all approach, and that if the state were to mandate how counties spent and implemented public safety realignment at the local level, there would be a much greater pushback from the local administrators in terms of adopting a public safety realignment. So, you know, I agree with Darris that there were a lot of external pressures that led to the willingness of the, you know, government officials to implement public safety realignment, but the reality is they did agree to do it, and I think that we would have seen that much less likely to happen if the state were to tell counties how to do it. But the other thing is that, you know, the state hasn't demonstrated that they know the solutions either. And so, you know, I think that we have to recognize that, you know, there's some counties who have done a much better job of setting up local infrastructures around community supports and, you know, substance abuse treatment, et cetera, than others. There are many counties that have relied, you know, much more intensively on incarceration. And so there's not one approach for the best way to mandate it. So, you know, I think, and there are also all kinds of legal restrictions that come in once the state is actually mandating something, right? So there are greater responsibilities for the state to cover those costs, et cetera. So there's some real practical reasons, too, for it not to make sense. But I completely agree that we need to be looking really carefully at the outcomes, and that if we look closely at how counties have spent their money, we will see that those counties who are investing in the kinds of programs that work and not just relying on incarceration are going to have far better outcomes. And so, you know, that once we promote that information, I think we need to create those kinds of incentives for counties to recognize, because they now bear the cost. I mean, one of the important things to recognize is that prior to public safety realignment, counties did not pay for state prison, right? I mean, so there was an incentive to send someone to prison because it was no longer a county cost, or at least there was not a disincentive to do so. And now, you know, you cannot return someone to prison on a parole violation, and that was a huge percentage of the people going into prison every year were actually people who were going in on violations. And so, you know, instead of being charged as a new crime, and now you can't do that. And so now it really is up to the counties to figure out how we're going to deal with it. So I think that, you know, it the incentives are now much more aligned toward trying to create invest in solutions that work. But the problem is that's not where we've been culturally. You know, there is this, what we know is relying on incarceration. You know, we treat drug addiction as if it's a criminal justice problem, not a public health problem. You know, we need to make that shift and invest in the public health solution so that we don't end up relying on the criminal justice system to respond to these problems, that it's not well equipped or initially designed to do.
And a Public Policy Institute of California report found better outcomes for counties that focus more on reentry and rehabilitation than enforcement, which is kind of a no-brainer, right?
Yes.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Robert. Let's go to our next caller, Steve in Santa Cruz. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you. I'd like to hear your guests' feedback about the percentage of those in state prison, perhaps the increasing percentage. They might be categorized, if you will, as incorrigible, or those who have adopted career criminal lifestyles and who are highly likely to reoffend and then get reincarcerated as a matter of a lifestyle, regardless of what rehabilitation programs might be in place.
Okay. First of all, I think it's a misconception of the type of individuals that are in prison. And I would say that the prison system, it treats most people in that 2 percentile that will never, probably develop a lifestyle that could be lived outside of prison.
That's 2%?
Yeah, and I would say it's about 2%. And then You have another percentage of men and women that are in prison who actually are older but have had a structure to kind of like fall back on. And so these are men and women that may have gotten caught up in, quote unquote, the war on drugs and so many of the things that came with it, which was divestment in their communities, which led to their offsprings becoming the new wave of people in prison. So when you talk about the younger generation that are going in and out of prison right now, especially when it comes to, and let's be, you know, candid in our conversation with African-American and Latinos, because we know those, you know, communities were actually, you know, targeted with divestment, and then what was invested into the community were, you know, an influx of drugs and guns, which actually led to where we are now. So really not having a foundation to look back on. And so I would think these individuals, what they need are things, and things studies have shown, and actually I've seen it, when you give a person who wants to do better the chance to do better, and also encouragement, and it's not just saying this is here or there, but the mentorship that's needed to go in and out of these minefields that they have no way of actually going through on their own, that works. And so when we begin to invest in peer-to-peer mentorship, see, one of the things that's actually missing in this whole conversation is that the system is very reluctant to invest in what we call peer-to-peer mentorship. That's taken like individuals like myself who have come out of prison. I could name people. One of the individuals who was on this radio show yesterday, Frankie Guzman, and others just like him. I could name people, men and women, who are doing great work within this system right now to help keep other people from going back in. If we invest more in them, allowing this peer-to-peer mentorship, then I guarantee you we would see a shift. But when you throw someone up to an individual that they cannot relate to, it's going to be very, very few people that actually turn themselves around when, say, John Q, who comes from the suburbs, who've never been in prison before, whether he or she is white or black or Hispanic, but they live in a totally different culture. They can't actually begin to become, like, let's say, relevant to a young person that is sitting in your seat. So that's what we need. And until we say, you know what, men and women who have been there actually do a better job than we do and invest in them, then we will start seeing, you know, better results. I guarantee you that.
And that's happening, right?
Yes, it is.
Elizabeth, what would you add to that?
Well, I want to reemphasize Darris's point that the percent of people who are in prison who are, you know, what we might think of as like the sociopath, it is a very, very small, you know, single-digit percentage. I mean, that, you know, that's a real small number of people, you know, relative to the prison population. The other reality is that, like it or not, 95% of people in prison are coming out. You know, they have a determinate sentence. They're coming out. And so the question is, you know, even if you believe that, you know, all of those people should be locked up, the reality is we how do you want them to come out? You know, and do we want to have, you know, the prisons where they don't have education programs, they don't have substance abuse programs, we're not addressing, you know, the reasons that they came in, or do we want to have programs where they're actually much more likely to come out successfully? And that means not just programs while they're in prison, but very, very importantly, programs provided immediately upon release, and then, you know, that are sustainable over the course of their time out in the community.
Well, you know, I'm sure we'll do a show about Prop 47 because it's getting a lot of attention right now. The Chronicle had a piece about finger pointing. There's been a 47% increase in San Francisco car break-ins in the first half of this year. And so you've got some people saying that it's a result of Prop 47. So San Francisco Police Chief Greg Suhr called out realignment during a hearing with the city's Government Audit and Oversight Committee addressing property crime. He said the reforms have contributed to an increase of low-level crime on city streets. But then you've got a district attorney, George Gascon, who helped push the initiative in San Francisco. He says only 4 people have been released from state prison. Only 12 have been released from county jail due to Prop 47. So as this debate is probably going to heat up in the coming months, Darris, what are your thoughts on this and Prop 47?
Well, first of all, I would say this. Law enforcement officials, anytime there's an uptick in crime, they'll always be quick to point out, well, it's because of this new legislation, without having time to actually do a study on what's going on. And so I would say this, right? Proposition 47 is a great law, and we would have liked to have seen it go a little further, it's a good law. And I would also point out this, too. You know, people who are always on the tough on crime bandwagon, right? They're very contradictory, because on one end, you're saying lock people up, okay? But on the other end, people are going to get out of prison. So if you don't want that person to become a victimizer of you, then why do we push policies that say, you know, you can't have a job, you can't do this, you can't do that? Well, heck, if you didn't have a job and you didn't have any resources to eat, couldn't get a place to sleep, what would you do? And we never ask ourselves that question. So Proposition 47 is a good law. And in my opinion, you know, the uptick in car burglaries, it has nothing to do with people that are being let out of prison or jail. I think we have to look at, you know, are these individuals committing these crimes that have never been to jail, but because of poverty, you know, they have taken to other things, especially in San Francisco. I mean, look at the poverty level. You know, look at the people that are being pushed out because of high rents and gentrification and the lack of sustainable employment. So I think we have to look at those issues and not look at Proposition 47 as being the key.
And Elizabeth, how do you see it? We've got about a minute left.
Yeah, I'd love to weigh in. Thank you. You know, any criminologist you talk to is going to say that it takes far more than 6 months to draw any conclusions about the impact of a law. And Darris is right. Every time there's a big reform, people want to point to it and say that that's changed, you know, that that's impacting crime. People did it after public safety realignment, and the Public Policy Institute of California came out last, you know, has found that, you know, crime has continued to go down. We're at all-time historic lows. Yes, there are fluctuations. Crime rates fluctuate, you know, down significantly, lowest levels since, you know, 1991. And yet there are always periods where it goes up, and people, you can't draw conclusions to what's happened. But it's much too early to be able to point the finger. And I think that, you know, the blame game is not helpful for public safety. What we need to look at are real solutions.
Elizabeth Siggins directs Californians for Safety and Justice's Local Safety Solutions Project. She spent almost 10 years with the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. Darris Young is a community organizer with the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights, and he spent 17 years in prison. Elizabeth and Darris, thank you for joining us.
Thank you
for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we continue our week-long series on the U.S. prison system by discussing media coverage of the issues we focused on this week. How we got here, reform, solitary confinement, and youth. We'll also talk about prison practices in Germany and the arrests of hundreds of human rights lawyers and activists in China. How do the media shape public views on prisons? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.